Hello and welcome to the Majlis podcast, Ready for Free the Liberties Current Affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Ready for Free the Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. The new report just got released by the anti-corruption watchdog, the Crude Accountability, called a model kleptocracy, looks into corruption in kleptocracy in Turkmenistan. The report particularly attempts to expose how the government funds are mismanaged, the ways in which the taxpayers' money is spent, and the role that the leadership might be playing in these corrupt practices. It's an exhaustive report with rare details on so many levels, including the involvement of the president's family and how some Western companies might be profiting from this opaque nature of the country. So there is a lot to discuss in this report, and we are joined by Tom Main, who is the author of the report, Maximilian Hess, fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Farouk Yusupov, the director of Ready for Free the Liberties Turkmen Service, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Free the Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So, Tom, you have discussed this report up to this point on so many platforms. So would you like to kick in the discussion by telling us about the report, which you call Turkmenistan a model for kleptocracy? How so? And what led you to this conclusion?
Well, thank you. It's great to be here today. I think it really takes up the story from when I last wrote in detail about Turkmenistan, which was back in 2006 in a report called It's a Gas. And it was that report that really established the fact that Turkmenistan was one of the most fiscally opaque countries in the whole world. It released very little information about how much it was earning from selling oil and gas. And then this report really established that the majority of the money under Niyazov was going to this foreign exchange reserve fund, this big fund held in Deutsche Bank. And so it seemed natural now, 15 years later, to do a follow-up to the report to see how things have changed. And in some ways, not much has changed. Money still flows to Deutsche Bank, and it is under the control of the president. And there is virtually no information about that what that money is used for. And seeing that Turkmenistan is undergoing a severe financial crisis, you really have to come to the conclusion that that money has been either wasted on vanity projects, mismanaged, or indeed embezzled.
Wow. There are so many points that we could be talking about today. Okay, let's go one by one. The Turkmen government is earning. It has always been opaque, of course, as you mentioned, during Niyazov's time, and now it continues to be the same way. I mean, is there any kind of estimate? Is there any number that you could put how much the government is earning and what are the source of their earnings?
Well, in terms of the foreign currency reserves, you know, we state that the last available figure we have from institutions like the IMF and the EBRD is 35 billion. Now, that was 6 years ago, and I think that number is dramatically reduced since then. In terms of, you know, the revenue, we know that the greatest sum of money comes from China through the gas exports. And we have in the report, I think, quite accurate data about what the price is of the gas plus the amount sold to China. And from that, we can make a pretty good estimate of how much the Turkmen government earned. So, for example, I think our figure for 2019 was, I think, $8.2 billion that the Turkmen government earned from selling gas to China. And indeed, if you look at information from the IMF in terms of export revenue after China, there was a massive drop off. And I think for 1 year, the number two country in terms of export revenue generated was, I think, Afghanistan, with around $300 million of exports, which would mainly be electricity. So that's $300 million in second place, China in first place at $8 billion. So that really shows you how important that gas trade with China is, and how much that Turkmenistan relies on that trade for its economic prosperity, for want of a better word, because as we know, it is not a prosperous country at the mm-hmm. moment. So that begs the question, just where has this money gone?
Did I misheard you earlier? You were saying that the money is still going to the Deutsche Bank?
No, that's right. We know that it's changed over the years with the creation of the state agency, but the current understanding is that 80% of the gas sales, including the sales to China, goes to this foreign exchange reserve fund, and only 20% goes to the Turkmen budget. You could say this is an improvement over Niyazov's day, because under Niyazov, no money from the sale of Turkmen oil and gas went to the budget. But, and this is something that Bruce has written a lot about, seeing that the budget published by the Turkmen government is so useless, it's only 2 pages long, the version we get to see, and there's no information about which of that money mentioned in the budget actually comes from the sale of oil and gas. So is this money even being transferred to the budget as defined by Turkmen law? We simply have no way of knowing.
Very interesting. Also, colleagues, there is a lot to talk about. I mean, I just wanted to remind that let's try to make this an interactive conversation. So whenever you have any question, I mean, Tom is here to answer all of that, stemmed from the report that he just released on behalf of the Crude Accountability. So let's try to read his brain on that. Max, you have looked into this financial dealings of Turkmenistan for a long time. Is there anything stands out to you from what we heard from Tom so far? And I'm sure that you have also went through the report that we are talking about today.
I found the report was really excellent. It's been long overdue that we get this kind of detailed analysis of Turkmenistan's oil and gas business in particular. For me, I mean, the bit that sort of stood out the most, and I think is from recent news that is worth highlighting, particularly in light of the report, is Turkmenistan's claims to have paid back a sort of key Chinese pipeline loan. And, you know, one of the things that the report makes quite clear, but is worth discussing a little bit more in detail, is how opaque government loan contracts are. And this is fairly standard in countries around the world. Governments are very good at managing their debt books, even when they're reviewed by the World Bank and the IMF. The World Bank notably doesn't usually include Turkmenistan's economic data because it is so unreliable. But it's quite clear that Turkmenistan still has sizable debts to China just because it claims this one was paid off. Now, it appears the debt that they're claiming has been repaid was one where they were making the repayments through essentially free gas deliveries. So China would take debt repayment in the form of gas.
Wow. While you were talking, I'm also trying to do a troubleshoot here. Farouk, I guess, is disconnected. I don't know what to do with that. Let's see how it goes. Bruce, any point at this point you would like to raise?
You know, I was kind of glad that Max got into the talking about these claims about paying off the debt. You know, you always have to look at the wording that the Turkmen use on these things to try to figure out where they're going with this. I mean, when people say, well, they paid off their debt, I think the actual wording was specifically that they said they had paid off for what China had invested in the Gulkanish field and for the pipeline, right? You know, and as Max said, there's a lot of other things here. You know, China is one of the primary weapon sellers to Turkmenistan, and I've always assumed that was also kind of on credit. And there's a lot of other things that China is providing to Turkmenistan, plus other countries, of course, too. But, you know, so when Turkmenistan, you know, at least the report I saw on a Turkmen government website referred specifically to the debt that had to do with the field and the pipeline, and said it's all paid off. And I'm like, well, that's some, you know, of the debt, but that's not all of the debt. So, you know, I was glad that Max brought that up just so it's really clear that we're not talking about all the money Turkmenistan owes to China being paid off. We're talking about specific, like one project specifically that's supposedly settled.
Yeah. And even then, that kind of adds into what this picture of what we are talking about today, this opaque nature of this kleptocracy in Turkmenistan. I know, Farouk, you are back. Thank you very much for coming back. You had some trouble joining us today. Farouk, of course, you look into Turkmenistan from a very different lenses than what we do from 10,000 feet above. So when you looked into this report that was just released by Crude Accountability, so what was some of the main takeaways for you in this report?
It is very interesting report and very rare because, as we know, Turkmenistan doesn't get much attention, unfortunately. We know that Turkmenistan is a kleptocratic country, and it has been for many years. One of the facts that was stated in the report was that surprised me was that it states that the money in this foreign exchange fund might have shrunk, indicating that President Berdimuhamedov somehow was spending it to alleviate some of the hardships that the Turkmen people are going through. I would imagine that President and his family, they view that fund as their personal savings, so to speak, and would not touch it to make the lives of ordinary Turkmens easier. The issue of Chinese debt, this issue was there for years, and it slashed Turkmenistan's revenues because some part of the revenues from the gas export to China were directed to cover those debts. Mm. President Berdimuhamedov didn't touch the foreign exchange reserves. Also, it was another indication for that was that during the Asian indoor games, they were scrambling to find money. They were squeezing out money from the entrepreneurs. They were squeezing out money from public workers. But that event that the Turkmen president viewed as a big Turkmen wedding, he did not want to spend the money from the funds because he doesn't want to spend that money. He saved from his point of view for himself and for his family.
But how do we know that there is even a money there? I mean, how much money is there in case if there is money?
I don't know. But Tom knows better because he researches this issue. But yeah, with Bruce, we estimated that it could be something above $20 billion in those reserves. But according to Tom and to the report, it was up to $35 billion in 2016. Mm-hmm. So it might have, maybe it shrunk, but from how people are struggling these days, they cannot buy simple bread. Mm-hmm. And from what we hear today, the subsidized foods that were now delivered to homes mm-hmm. once a week, now they're going to be delivered once in mm-hmm. 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't show that the government is spending much, even from the current revenues that they are getting from the Turkmen gas exports mm-hmm. to China. Mm-hmm. We know that Tom rightly mentioned that in 2019, the revenues were $8.6 billion. But in 2020, it was slashed by a third, and they only made $6 billion in revenues from selling their gas to China. So it's going down. And with it's going down, the lives of the ordinary people is worsening. Mm-hmm. While those vanity projects are continuing. Just yesterday, he opened another international airport in the middle of nowhere in Kherky district, which is far, far in the deserts, closer to the Afghan border. It's a small town. It's a small district, and they are opening multi-million dollar projects in the desert. And they opened a stupid, silly Turkmen Ak Oy, this Turkmen yurt in Turkmenabad. So, and they're planning another luxury hotel in Ashgabat. Mm. Just insane what's going on.
Yeah, you know, that Farooq kind of points into a very important angle here. I mean, earlier, Tom, you discussed this. People might be suffering because of the impact of the pandemic or unemployment, or which all leads into the economic situation that the country is in today. But when it comes to these vanity projects, as Farooq was talking about, they always find money for that. So there is something to look into this. I mean, what's the connection, do you see, a direct connection between those vanity projects and the kleptocracy?
Well, I think it reinforces the personality cult. Certainly in Niyazov's day, we knew that those vanity projects were funded from the Foreign Exchange Reserve Fund, EBRD and other institutions said as much. The picture is more opaque under Berdimuhamedov. It's possible that the martial art games and the Ashgabat airport, I think roughly combined, that's about $10 billion. It's possible that they were funded in part from the Foreign Exchange Reserve Fund. But as you've pointed out, also money was garnered from the people for these projects. So that doesn't really suggest that there is that much money kicking around at all. So it's an open question. Are those reserves just sitting there and are being spent by Berdimuhamedov and his family, or have they been whittled away, used on these vanity projects by Berdimuhamedov, so that there's just literally no money in the tank to spend on trying to alleviate the people's suffering? Not that that is ever at the foremost of Berdimuhamedov's mind, but it is I think that is the crux of the question. Is this money there and not being spent, or is it just simply not there?
Max, you are raising your hand. Great that you are doing that. Go ahead.
Thank you. One point that I think is, you know, worth mentioning on the foreign exchange reserves as well is the role that foreign exchange can play in corruption, in particular domestically and in a country like Turkmenistan, where there's an official exchange rate that is very different from the black market exchange rate, which we've seen spike again over the last year. And a common sort of tool of corruption used by kleptocratic regimes around the world, Venezuela is perhaps the most well-known recent example, is using this mismatch in currency rates to enrich both the ruling elite themselves and their allies. So, you know, what would happen in that case is essentially those in the regime and close to the regime would be allowed to exchange or use letters of credit to get access to dollars in, and then resell it basically domestically, get the manat, do it again, and then pocket the difference. Mm. So it's, you know, certainly quite possible, and there have been indications in the past that this happens in Turkmenistan as well, and that may explain why the regime has been so secretive about it. Mm. And of course, the effect of doing that is to move the dollars or other hard currency foreign reserves out of any such funds and into the pockets of the regime and its friends. Mm.
It's a good point you raised there, because you may have seen on the internet, there seems to be all these Turkmen manat for sale in Germany and Ukraine and France. And it really is a good question, what is happening here. And I think that the picture that you paint is accurate, that manat being maybe shipped out of Turkmenistan, and that mismatch in the exchange rate is being exploited. Some reports that construction companies, some of the big ones, have been able to get Deutsche Bank to pay out at the official rate, which that way means they're really making a hell of a killing. And the result of that is you have all these manat available for sale in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. So it's something that deserves further research, what is happening here and who's benefiting.
Mm. Very interesting. And also earlier, I think that, Tom, you hinted to that. I mean, these vanity projects have always been there, like during Niyazov's time, perhaps in a smaller scale, but it has been there. And also this kind of secretive way of Turkmenistan dealing with the international companies or governments, it has also been practiced. So when you compare today's situation in the context of kleptocracy, Berdimuhamedov's government with Niyazov, what are some of the striking points that draws your attention?
Well, I think it's much more centralized now around the family. One of the only positive things you can say about Niyazov is that he didn't have too many family members. He was estranged from his wife. He'd fallen out with his son. His daughter lived abroad. He was, of course, an orphan himself. But with Berdimuhamedov, you've got many more mouths to feed. You've got five sisters. And you have some of those relatives, especially the nephews, shown to be very active in Turkmen business and seem to be hoovering up all the lucrative contracts that are available in Turkmenistan. You have the son obviously being groomed for the presidency, but let's not forget the daughters who are with their husbands on various diplomatic missions across the world. There's a big question about how much they are a part of this kleptocratic system and if they're helping their father siphon some of this money out of Turkmenistan. The one that's often mentioned, and we know lots about this from other countries in the region, is real estate. We know that the Kazakh formerly now ruling family Nazarbayev children have lots and lots of real estate in London and in Europe especially. And Radio Liberty has done some great work on uncovering that, totaling hundreds of millions of dollars, and it wouldn't surprise me if the Turkmen First family has done a similar thing by acquiring real estate around Europe and especially in London.
Very, very interesting. Earlier, one of the NGOs, what was the name? Alternative Turkmenistan, I guess, they put out, though very in a smaller scale, the list of the properties acquired by the Turkmen ambassador in Washington, D.C. in different parts of the United States. Yeah, that's a very interesting point to look into. I mean, perhaps Berdimuhamedov's family members might be in this business in this or the other way. I mean, the mention of family kind of reminds me of those very famous joke. Whoever went to Egypt, they will remember. I mean, there was lots of Egyptians are notorious with jokes about their presidents, and especially during the time of Hosni Mubarak, there were lots of jokes about how presidents' family members were involved in different sorts of shady businesses. So about the family. aspect. It's very interesting. What the rules are in this whole shady activity, and also the report questions about the way in which some of the Western companies benefit from this opaque situation. How so, and what all this means to democracy and human rights? Let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Tom Main, a research fellow at the University of Exeter and also the author of the report that we are talking about today. Maximilian Hess, a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Farouk Yusupov, the director of Ready for Pretty Liberty's Turkmen Service. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Pretty Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Ready for Pretty Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing kleptocracy in Turkmenistan in the context of the recent report by the Kurd Accountability, the family members. So there are so many kind of uncorroborated reports about the involvement of the family members in day-to-day life of Turkmens and Turkmenistanis there. But in this report, Tom, again, kind of coming back to you, you guys try to nail down some of the occurrences on the factual grounds. So tell us a little bit about where you see them active and what they are doing.
Well, as you say, you know, this is a topic which is very hard to find accurate information about. And certainly when you compare it again to Kazakhstan, everybody knows the people involved there. And there are, you know, pages and pages of books written about, you know, the assets that the Nazarbayev family own. It's not that way when we deal with Turkmenistan. And it was only, I think, you know, towards the end of researching the report that we got some accurate information about what the daughters actually are called. You know, on many websites, one of the daughters has been named as Gulshan. A lot of my Turkmen colleagues were saying, well, that's not really a common name. Don't you mean Gulshat? And then finally, we learn that it's actually Gulcihan and Gulcihan. And we know from documents that we've seen that at one point, both daughters and their husbands were acting as diplomats in the UK. And when you combine that with some other information, such as the WikiLeaks cables, which talks about, you know, Dovlet Atabayev and maybe acquiring some real estate in London and maybe possessing another house in the south of France, it starts to build up a picture about, you know, what this family is doing.
But I know, Farouk, you guys look into family members from a very, very local perspective. So just wonder, there are a number of people, of course, as Tom was talking about, I mean, Berdi Muhammad has lots of mouth to feed. So who seems to be more active than the other?
You mean in business? If it's business, it is his sisters and their families control the biggest part of the Turkmen economy. One nephew is Shamarat. Shamarat Recepov, he's a very notorious figure in Turkmenistan.
Oh, the guy with lots of watches, right?
That's another one. That's son-in-law of one of the sisters. So they are very active. Berdi Muhammedov's son was not involved in a lot of business activities, being presidential son, but now he's, as we know, being groomed to replace Berdi Muhammedov as president. But in economy, his numerous nephews and nephews-in-law are very active. And from what we know, Berdi Muhammedov is quite subordinate to his sister's wishes.
Interesting.
Whenever some trouble happens with their sons, then they come to Berdi Muhammedov and they get what they want. But from his immediate family, as Tom mentioned, one of his daughters at least is in London with her husband. And there are unconfirmed reports that they own properties and businesses abroad, including in France and in Germany too, by the way, and Italy.
You know, it's who's that?
I was going to say, and don't forget Dubai, where the other son-in-law is.
Dubai.
And you know, from what we know about Dubai, it's clear that I think a lot of money is going through there because of the presence of the son-in-law Amanov.
Amanov's there in Dubai.
Yeah, he's a diplomat in Namar in Dubai, married to Gulcihan, another of the daughters, and so you know that's been established, and you know there are. as you say, there's a lot of not necessarily rumors, but information that is difficult to corroborate. But I think task with this report was to put it all in one place and to hope that leads to further research to kind of drill down on some of these claims and see what else we can find.
And Amanov, Ikhlas Amanov, I think his name, and he is general consul in Dubai. And from what we heard, he was appointed to be one of the top diplomats in Dubai because family decided that it is easier to get whatever they earn from Turkmenistan through Dubai, because it's like over the past several years, there were a lot of investigated cases of money laundering from other countries in the region, like Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan. So they decided that Dubai would be a safer haven for funneling whatever they make on the backs of ordinary Turkmen.
Yeah, of course, lots of import items comes through Dubai to Turkmenistan. Bruce, that's kind of interesting to me. Like we were comparing a little bit Berdi Muhammadov's way of doing business with those of Niyazov. I mean, he took this kind of a different direction compared to Niyazov. I mean, by involving lots of his family members into business, into politics, like per se, Serdar seems to be very visible. But now, as our colleagues are talking about, his son-in-laws are in various diplomatic posts here and there. So there are lots of activities going on involving his immediate family members. So what's the trick there? I mean, why he did what he did compared to Niyazov?
Well, if you look at the system, Tom already pointed out one that Niyazov just simply didn't have that many relatives. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't very good. He wasn't on good terms with any of them, really. So the opportunities were much more limited in that respect. You know, and I think you also got to remember Niyazov's heritage. I mean, he came out of the Soviet system. He was appointed head of Turkmenistan long before the other guys were that ended up being presidents. 84 or something, they put him in, and so he was clearly an apparatchik and had some understanding of at least Soviet order and rules and stuff. Certainly there's ways to get around that, but at least he would have had a different concept of how you could run a country and how much money you could steal, because he would have been used to the communist system where at any moment, you could have got caught and sent off to Siberia, disgraced, disappeared entirely, something like that. Berdi Muhammadov, he had a Soviet experience, but he had no government experience, really. And I think, that's one thing that's worth remembering, is that he doesn't ever understand, that he was the leader of the country. There was no way he could get caught. Niyazov was coming out of something different, where in the back of his mind, it was possible that he could get caught or that it would be everything he was doing was exposed. But I don't think Berdi Muhammadov has that same understanding of his responsibility toward governance at all. For him, it's like a big park, right? Turkmenistan's his playground, and all the money that comes in is his. That's why he wants all the buildings white. That's why he flies over to look at his toy model, that's inhabited with the people of the country and stuff. He's like a little kid playing with toys, really. That's what it looks like. So he has all these family members. And let's face it, when you're spending money like that and hurling abuse at different officials, and rotating them through, which was Niyazov's system and the way it went, you probably don't make a lot of friends outside your family. There's the elites and they get some money, but you kind of box yourself into a situation where the only people you can really trust are the people you know best that are closest to you, because you just don't know people that you think are smarter than you, that are in the government or something like that, are a threat. Yeah. But your family, especially in the Central Asians' understanding of upbringing and stuff, you're all supposed to hang together. Mm. Not that they haven't had problems with families in Central Asia in the past where there was betrayals, but I think that, he's kind of in the same boat as like Rahman in Tajikistan is a lot like that too, where the only one he can trust really 100% are the people in his family. Yeah. And so they get to split all the wealth with him, and he depends on them for support and a few trusted officials that are around him or advisors that are around him. But otherwise, he has no reason to want to see anyone else get rich or smart or popular or anything like that. It's just a threat to him. As long as he keeps it within the family, there's this feeling of security because it's all close to home.
Yeah, on the other point, again, coming back to the report, perhaps Max, if you like to jump in here, otherwise Tom. So the report also tries to bring in how Western, some of the Western companies fits in to this nature of kleptocratic way of dealing in Turkmenistan. So where it relates to those Western companies, Tom or Max, jump in, please.
I'll take this one, and then Max, you can take it. I think the report makes clear that a lot of these companies, especially Bouygues, Polymex, and Itera, they would not be rich without Turkmenistan. The Bouygues fortune is built on all those dozens of buildings they've built in Ashgabat and elsewhere. And I think when it comes to Western companies, perhaps some of those companies a little bit lower down the chain, they have to be aware that one way they are supporting a kleptocracy, because any monies generated through taxes or whatever will go to ultimately to Berdimuhamedov, but two, that they are likely to be co-opted into this very corrupt system. We have a few examples in the report. Daimler, of course, were prosecuted by the US authorities for giving bribes. It was a luxury sedan to Niazov. And we also have a case study of an unnamed oil and gas company that was basically forced to cut the books in order to make it look like a lot of drilling had been going on in order to please the people back in the West, when actually no drilling was going on. But the only way that the country manager felt he could survive was by cooking the books, because of the way the system is in Turkmenistan. So is it even possible to do business honestly in Turkmenistan? Mm. And I would very much say that I think that it isn't. And any company out there has to be aware that that's the case. And people like Crude Accountability and others will be looking at their activities very closely.
Is there anything, Max, you would like to add into this?
I certainly won't comment on the report itself. I think Tom is the right person to do that. I would say there is a long tradition of Western companies doing some business in Turkmenistan, and many of them have remained remarkably stable over the years. Perhaps sort of the most notable example is John Deere, an American tractor and agricultural goods manufacturer that first established a very sort of sizable relationship with Turkmenistan under Niyazov in the 1990s. And there was a great movie that came out at some point in the 2000s called Shadow of the Holy Book that looked at some of these relationships, including, I think it was in the John Deere Museum, they had a copy of the Ruhnama that Berdimuhamedov had given them. And there was a bit of shaming, but if you go to this year, even now, almost annually, John Deere makes quite sizable sales to Turkmenistan. Now, is there sort of direct corruption involved in there that I can prove? Certainly not. But I would say being shown on these companies and how they partner with Turkmenistan is definitely warranted. And
Max, you are cutting off.
Essentially more sunlight on Western companies' involvement in Turkmenistan is very much warranted.
Hmm. Yeah, I think we could be talking about this in many more details, but we also need to wrap up the discussion here. Of course, this is also part of the report that was brought up. I mean, the cost of all this on human rights, and also the cost of all this on human lives in Turkmenistan. So from that perspective, I know, Faruk, you have something to say from that perspective on the connection of this to the situation of human rights. What comes to your mind, Faruk or Bruce? Anyone who wants to jump in here?
The whole situation, the whole style of governing by the Berdimuhamedov regime is a big human rights abuse, because people are suffering from mismanaged economy. They are on the verge of hunger. People suffer from constant extortions. The public workers, and we know that public sector is the main employer in the country, up to 80% of employed people are work in public sector. They are constantly deprived of their wages. People are exploited on cotton fields and in other parts of agriculture. because the government doesn't want to invest in reforming the sector. People are being exploited in various state events. This week they're having Week of Culture in Leba province, and everyone is being exploited like slaves under scorching heat. So it's a big human rights abuse. And it is, unfortunately, as I pointed out in the beginning, Turkmenistan doesn't receive much attention from international media. Only they pay attention only when President Berdimuhamedov performs one of his stunts, like sings a song or fires a gun. And that might seem funny, but life in Turkmenistan is not fun for ordinary Turkmens.
It's very complicated, painful details that we are talking about today. Speaking of the impact of all this on human lives, I think in one of the other sessions that we were having yesterday, I mentioned this. You know, these days, because of the COVID-19, these days there is no flight coming out of Turkmenistan except some occasional charter planes. Now, for anyone who wants to leave the country or to be able to get on board to that plane, you have to pay like $1,000+. It's not a price of the ticket, but it is just a, you know, simply bribe that, and that puts you on that plane to leave the country. It's just that, you know, they find ways how to, as Farouk, you were talking about earlier, extort money from any kind of circumstances, any situation. I think we need to end the conversation here, but just I'm looking into some of the final notes that I have. You know, I don't know. I mean, I was just looking into the report. I don't know if there's any solution can be proposed in situation like this, but usually reports do carry like a kind of conclusive remarks and the steps can be taken to improve the situation. Is there anything that comes to your mind, Tom, Bruce, or Hass, with that we are going to conclude the conversation? I mean, the situation is as bad as it is. Is there anything that can improve it?
Well, I agree with you in that sometimes the recommendations that accompany a report on Turkmenistan are just, you know, far-fetched and things that would never really happen. You know, from my time working on the oil industry, for example, asking Turkmenistan to join the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. I mean, to do that, you would need, you know, NGOs that actually work on oil and gas transparency issues. And as we know, that's never going to happen in Turkmenistan. So it is very hard to come up with recommendations. What I would say is that we do have a few tools at our disposal to, you know, sanction corruption and human rights abuses, such as the global Magnitsky sanctions regime in the US, and there are similar regimes being set up in the UK and the EU, and we have to use them. And it's very surprising that no Turkmen official has been sanctioned yet by the under the Global Magnitsky Act. And I think this has to change for the US to put a marker down to say that this kind of behavior is not acceptable.
And I also kind of wonder, I mean, you mentioned like some of the relatives, family members might be involved in some of the shady stuff in London. I mean, how they go unnoticed by the local authorities there. I don't know if there's anything that can be brought up on that. Max, Bruce, is there anything you would like to add in this? I mean, we have spoken. Yes, this seems to be Berdimuhamedov and his family is doing the kleptocratic nature of the opaque nature of the government that they are running. But there is also links to the international community in the context of some of those things are happening in foreign countries and foreign soils. And some there are some international companies might be facilitating some of those bad practices. I mean, is there any recommendations that comes to your mind which might have the chance to improve the situation in the country?
You know, London in particular and other similar markets, I think where one sort of key step that needs to be taken is really opening property registries and commercial registries and making them less opaque. There's so many structures used to hide ownership and the like, and I don't think that we're all of a sudden going to find the magic solution that stops corrupt money from being able to flow out, but we should at least improve our own regulatory regimes to shine more light on it. That combined with some of the potential sanction steps Tom mentioned, you know, it won't stop everything, but it could be effective.
Anything, any point, Bruce? Otherwise, I'm going to conclude the discussion here.
So just, I mean, you were right about raising the fact that, they have a lot of Western enablers in this, and I think that's the biggest shame of this, for me anyway, to watch this and try to understand why Western governments and Western companies put so much value on Turkmenistan. You could have made the argument, you know, years ago that maybe they'll build a Trans-Caspian pipeline and the gas will get to Europe, and so they diversify and they're not so dependent on Russian gas and stuff. But, you know, let's face it, the Trans-Caspian isn't going to get built anytime soon. And you can make the argument that, well, they were going to do TAPI, right? So Afghanistan will profit. You get something out of that in Pakistan and India and everything like that. But that's also not going to happen. And in fact, the way things are going in Afghanistan, the current Afghan government might not even be in power very much longer. Mm. And the U.S. is getting out. They're not going to get back in. So Turkmenistan loses geostrategic significance for the U.S. and its NATO allies that have been participating in the operation in Afghanistan. So what makes Turkmenistan of any value at all anymore to so many of these governments? And if that's the case, then isn't it time for one of them to call them out at the U.N. or something? All you have to do is say, we want an embargo on trade with them or some kind of sanctions or something. That'll scare them, and that'll work, you know, because they don't have that many options. And in the meantime, they're just a horrible model for the region. Tajikistan, as we've done on one of these podcasts, Tajikistan starts to look a lot more like Turkmenistan in the last few years. And Uzbekistan is starting on that same path, too. You know, so instead of the model being Kyrgyzstan and democracy, you know, which kind of went away, the model for some of these countries is now Turkmenistan, it looks like. Oh, and that's because no one called them out. And it's like a cancer sitting there in the corner of Central Asia that's infecting other countries. And like I said, we get almost nothing out of this. You know, mm-hmm. there's really not much you can. What's the value of Turkmenistan? Mm-hmm. Like I said, why is it important?
Yeah, but that kind of brought me to another point. In fact, perhaps Tom, you know, before doing this report, of course, we know you from your landmark investigations about some of those countries and the corrupt business practices there. You know, I don't know if there is any dealings that Turkmenistan might have with international financial institutions. I'm just thinking about here is, of course, Deutsche Bank is there. I mean, lots of money goes there. But keeping that aside, international financial institutions like World Bank, like IMF, or maybe Asian Development Bank, I mean, does Turkmenistan has any kind of dealings with them? So the question I have in mind here is how those institutions feels about what's going on in the context of the topic of your this recent report?
Well, in terms of the EBRD, you know, they've been playing this game for the last 20 years where they have to try and pretend that Turkmenistan is interested in moving towards a, you know, free market economy, and it's simply not. And, you know, there are a few projects in Turkmenistan that the EBRD supports, and quite rightly they've stayed away from oil and gas projects because of the possibility that those would benefit the president. But, you know, even these projects, like a beer factory, you know, I mean, are they really helping the populace, or are they helping, you know, one of the dozen or so families that are well connected in Turkmenistan? What we want to see from the EBRD, the World Bank, and the IMF is accurate information. And often it's slightly changed this year with the IMF giving its own assessment of the GDP growth in Turkmenistan rather than the Turkmenistan's inflated figure. Mm-hmm. But generally, these institutions have been fine with going along, you know, parroting these absurd figures of economic growth, and they need to get tougher and report the accurate information. And if they can't do that, they need to get out of those countries. And as Bruce says, you know, what better sign to the Turkmens that things aren't going well by having these major financial institutions pull out of the country and say, you know, we're not dealing with you until you reach a very basic level. We're not even talking about a good level, but the basic level of transparency that the Turkmen people deserve. Mm.
Yeah, I know. I wish that we would have Kate Waters here, the executive director of the Crude Accountability, the organization which released this report. I mean, she is more active on the advocacy front than Tom, you might be. So perhaps she might have some insight into when these type of questions are raised in front of the leadership of those financial institutions, what kind of response they give. But maybe some other time. But with this, you know, we need need to conclude the conversation here. Thank you very much, Tom Main, a research fellow, the University of Exeter, and also the author of the report that we discussed today, Turkmenistan, a Model for Kleptocracy. Maximilian Hess, fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Farouk Yusupov, the director of Radio Free Pride Liberties Turkmen Service, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Pride Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Pride Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.